Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, a young boy from the Winston Projects walks by a pawn shop, and a shiny guitar catches his eye. His family pulls together its money and buys it for him. So began Russell Thomas's musical journey. His new album is out, and it's bound to put a smile on your face. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, Mary Dalton brings us a Frank Capra Christmas classic. No, not It's a Wonderful Life, but it does evoke the Christmas spirit while being just a little outside the holiday norm. Then we'll get right back into the holiday pocket, so to speak, with a nod to Handel and his perennial favorite oratorio, Messiah. Messiah's never too hot to handle for Winston-Salem Symphony music director Robert Moody, because after 100 performances, he knows this music cold. From the art of conducting, we jump to the art of framing, and Hampton House Art and Framing's Mark Hampton provides the perfect fit. Greensboro artist William Mangum has the perfect painting to set inside that frame next after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Jazz musician Russell Thomas fell in love with the electric guitar as a boy, growing up in the Kimberley Projects in Winston-Salem and listening to local bands like Ghetto Soul. By the age of 16, Russell was already performing with local rhythm and blues bands of his own, and a move to Detroit and a brush with greatness ultimately set him on his life's quest. His new CD is titled Morning Train. I recently caught up with Russell in between gigs at his home in Winston-Salem. He started off on the living room couch with a performance of his original song, Kiss of the Morning Sun. That's a beautiful playing, Russell. Thank you so much for sharing that. What a great way to start off our chat here. You know, when I hear that, there's so much going on as a musician. I'm just curious to know how you're able to get those sounds. What's going on with your right and left hand to create this illusion of really two or even three guitars going on and playing at the same time?
Thank you, Dave. It's basically how I could describe it is you got some what theorists call contrary motion going on in there.
When you say contrary motion, what do you mean by that in terms of the music? What's going on there?
One voice goes in the backwards direction and the other voice goes in the forward direction. And so it sounds like this here.
That's such a beautiful harmony too. When you began writing A Kiss of the Morning Sun, how did that song evolve in your hands?
Well, actually, the music itself comes first, and after I get the sound where I want it and the composition where I want it, and it's complete, I then assign a title to it, one that is appropriate to the song itself.
It's a beautiful image and a really lovely melody. I love that. It makes you feel good to hear that.
Thank you, David. My own music soothes my soul a lot and keeps me in check a lot with my environment.
Tell me how your early years in music and listening and how guitar came into your life.
Yeah, it started when I was 13 years old. I saw a guitar in the pawn shop window, and I identified with it and I really wanted to have it. But prior to that, it was local bands played in my area down in the projects where we lived, here in Winston-Salem.
Whereabouts was that?
On a street called Deary Street, it was some Kimberley Projects, and the bands would come there and play their music, and I was just captivated by it. I saw the electric guitar players, they did their thing, and they did it well.
Was this, are we talking like James Brown covers? What sorts of tunes are we talking about?
A band back in those days called Ghetto Soul. A guy named Herbert Stevens played the electric guitar, and he showed me which way to go with it by me watching him play. And that's what I wanted to do. I realized that's what I wanted to do. And so after I saw the guitar in the window, I came home and asked my mom to buy it, and she and my uncle pulled their monies together and bought me the guitar, and I got started. And after maybe 3 years of playing around with the guitar, I joined up with a local band in my area.
At this point, you were in your teen years?
About 16 years old, yes, sir. And I started playing around with a local rhythm and blues band, a band called Odyssey.
And then a trip to Detroit was like another change in your whole musical evolution.
My uncle gave me a bus ticket to go to Detroit and come and stay with my aunties and uncle there. And I was playing a jazz combo there, the electric guitar, and they gave me a chance to get started with them, and they took me around, and they showed me how to play for people who were like ballrooms kind of playing the music. They did that kind of jazz, and that was a new chapter in my life. And so one day the guys asked me I should go see a guy named Earl Clue, and I had no idea why I should go see him or why would they mention this to me. But I took their advice, and I went to see him at a local club. It was called Baker's Keyboard Lounge. And I went there, and I saw Earl Clue. He was maybe he was 25 years old. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. A guy just sitting there playing a guitar by himself, and he held the attention of his audience. And people came out to see him in great numbers. He played this music, and I never heard any music like that in my life, and I never knew music could go that way. And just play a guitar and make music with a guitar. I never knew that. So the next day, I put down my electric guitar and went out and bought a classical guitar. People directed me what kind of guitar I was inquiring about. I had no idea I was wanting a classical guitar.
That's right. We should let listeners know that Earl Clue, unlike a lot of the jazz guitarists at the time, was not playing electric. It was an acoustic setup and a very beautiful, warm sound.
Yes, sir. He had great tone on this instrument. And the tone of the instrument, I think that's the greatest impact that it had on the listeners, the tone that the musician has. He had a tone that I never heard in my life.
Well, you certainly have taken that tone and made it your own, Russell, because you get a beautiful sound on this instrument. Describe the instrument for us and maybe just play a scale or something slow so we can just hear that, just that sound, anything. So beautiful. You know, you just have one of those sounds like this. Say, just play anything for me, Russell. Play me a scale, play me an arpeggio. It sounds great. Well, you know, I love to share with listeners that sound in the context of your new CD. Let's start off the title cut. So this is Morning Train. And that's the title cut from Russell Thomas's new CD, Morning Train. And, you know, I just love that to start off a CD because it's just got that beautiful forward motion. How do you create that?
Thank you, David. The basic construction of the song is progressions. It progresses from chord to chord. The progressions allows it to move. And also the 4/4 timing of the songs, having four measures per phrase. and 4 beats per measure. That also creates the flow of the music, David.
You're somebody who studied this stuff. I mean, you not only read music, but in your construction and composition, it comes with some experience.
Yes, sir. It came by a lot of instruction, yes. And after you, after one receives the instruction, it comes with a lot of sitting down and letting the rain fall in your mind and letting the seeds come up. And so one has to take time to, as they say, woodshed. As musicians used to call woodshed. And after you come out of college, I found that you have to take some time and just let your mind grow with all that knowledge that pumped into your mind.
I want to hear some more music after that. That just, it makes me feel so good. This is Jesus is Alive from Russell Thomas's CD, Morning Train. Jesus is Alive, beautiful song, and I love the mix of styles with the percussion involved too. Tell me about the percussion instrument we're hearing.
Yes, I used a drum machine that I programmed the percussions with, and I arranged the percussions the way I thought was the flow of the rhythm of the song. And basically I used the congas and light cymbals. That seemed to go well with acoustic guitar. It really seemed to go well with the personal kind of touch that I wanted to convey to people, and that went well with me.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it doesn't get in the way at all with what you're doing with your guitar, because those guitar lines themselves, there's a lot to listen for. There's some beautiful things happening there with your right and left hands. I love the mix of styles you get, too. How do you describe what you do? It's really unique to me. Russell Thomas.
Thank you, David. I would describe it as music that is personable. The guitar ministers to the listener one-on-one, and it connects with the listener in his or her own dimensional way.
That's such a beautiful way of putting it. And that, I mean, isn't that kind of the goal of any musician, whether you're in a stadium full of people or in a small club, you want to make that connection with people.
Yes, sir. And I think, David, being that I played the classical guitar, that itself has a lot of open up the door to connecting with people on a personal level. The guitar itself is inviting to the listener. Instead of overpowering them, it invites them to come in closer to it and just hear what it's saying, listen to what it's saying.
What role has spirituality played in your music, Russell?
Yes, the good Lord, he's the orchestrator of it all, David. Indeed, I do serve the good Lord, and my objective is to play venues and things that it would not be crushing or disagreeable to my own spirit or countenance. I like to feel like when I play for venues, I have to feel that I'm at peace with myself. And as far as playing for nightclubs and things like that, that don't make me feel at ease with myself. And I think it don't make the good Lord feel at ease with me also. My objective is to keep it clean, keep my performances clean.
Great. And the crown of righteousness is certainly clean and beautiful. Let's hear that. A crown of righteousness. Music by Russell Thomas from his CD, Morning Train. Thank you. Thomas, this is a beautiful song as well, and so much going on there. Again, it's hard on the radio to even picture the fact that it's just you playing all these lines. How do you play the bass line and that melody and the accompaniment line at the same time? Could you describe what's going on with your hands?
I think I could show you better on the guitar, David.
I saw your left hand, actually the thumb came down to press down the frets as you're playing with your right.
Yes, it's very useful that when the guitar itself, when you're playing so many voices or as many as you could possibly play, and the guitar must express another sound from some other string, the thumb itself will support, it'll come in and support naturally.
Well, Russell, thank you so much for taking time out to talk with me today.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share my music with you and giving me a great boost, David. Thank you so much.
Jazz guitarist Russell Thomas. We've been sampling from his new CD, Morning Train. The 2013 release is out on the Tate Music Group label. You'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Russell recently performed live at the Muddy Creek Cafe in Winston-Salem, and you can hear him perform periodically at the Bojangles restaurants on Stratford and Rinalda Roads. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short break, it's the King of the Baroque, his greatest hit, and a conductor who knows his oratorio like the back of his hands. Winston-Salem Symphony Music Director Bob Moody is here, and hallelujah, it's Handel's Messiah. Mary Dalton takes us behind the scenes with Frank Capra and more next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and there are many great holiday traditions here in the Piedmont Triad. One of them involves the Winston-Salem Symphony and one of classical music's most powerful messages of faith, Handel's Messiah. This year, once again, Maestro Robert Moody conducts the Winston-Salem Symphony and Chorale for two dynamic performances.
I think that I have now conducted performances of Messiah over 100 times. It's certainly the piece I've conducted the most of any in my now, hard to say this out loud, near 25 years of professional conducting. And I keep falling more and more in love with it. It's interesting. It's almost like people say this about great works. You know, you read a favorite book and you get more out of it every time you go back and reread it. I tend to be that way, by the way, with movies. One of my little secrets is I saw Avatar 22 times at the movie theater. So if I'm a little, like, maybe it fits my personality that I want to go back to something that I really think is great, and I happen to think Handel's Messiah is a miraculous work.
From Bob Moody on the podium, performance 1, to here 2013, performance 100. Give me an inkling as to something you picked up along the way that's helped give you more of an appreciation for the work, and maybe you can deliver that to the audience in performance.
In the early days, I found myself most excited about the connection between Baroque music and the energy of jazz. There was a Handel's Messiah symposium at Eastman, and the short story is that we were rehearsing For Unto Us a Child Is Born, and singing it badly, with the emphasis too much on the heavy beats, you know, For Unto Us a Child Is Born, etc. Awful. And we were then encouraged to switch and sing it, you know, like Swingle Singers on Doobie Doobie Doo. So we're singing, you know, For Unto Us a Child Is Doobie 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 Doobie. Well, that energy was a revelation for me. I would say in the past number of years, especially here in Winston-Salem, I've become more and more focused on the text painting. You know, Christianity happens to be my faith, so it does become a personal thing for me as well. But I'm mostly taken by the painting of the text, so that the way his yoke is easy, his burden is light, is painted bar by Handel to really match the words and to give another description of the text, I find amazing. And I've really enjoyed trying to move the instrumental playing more and more in a way that it almost becomes a vocal component. You know, when the trumpet shall sound happens with baritone and trumpet, Nita Serb is one of the very best in this entire business, there's hands down. And the way she plays this piece, it really becomes a conversation between baritone, solo, and trumpet. And I think that's what Handel intended.
Winston-Salem Symphony music director Robert Moody. He'll lead the orchestra and chorale in two performances of Handel's Messiah, Tuesday night, December 17th, and Wednesday night, the 18th, at 7:30 in Centenary United Methodist Church. Tickets range from $10 to $45, and you'll find links at wfdd.org. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to go behind the scenes with guest commentator, Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton.
For a lot of people, I think the holidays mean movies, and for a lot of people, that means Frank Capra this time of year. But you know, I'm not talking about It's a Wonderful Life, that perennial favorite. 5 years before Capra made It's a Wonderful Life, he made Meet John Doe, which was released in 1941. Both of the films have depression themes. They're both very cynical about rich people and power and government, and they both have Christmas. In this film, Barbara Stanwyck plays a reporter who's just been downsized, and in this sort of desperate effort to save her job, she creates a desperate character she calls John Doe. And then, when people sort of get pulled into the story she's invented, just as she hoped they would, she's called upon to produce the guy. And of course, he doesn't exist, so she has to have this massive casting call. And none of the guys are quite right until Gary Cooper walks in. And then Gary Cooper, of course, is the perfect John Doe and cast as the leader of this fictional movement.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Kenneth Fry speaking for the New Bulletin. Tonight we give you something entirely new and different. Standing beside me is the young man who has declared publicly that on Christmas Eve he intends to commit suicide, giving as his reason, quote, "I protest against the state of civilization," end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, the New Bulletin takes pleasure in presenting the man who is fast becoming the most talked of person in the whole country, John Doe.
Don't you think that's weird? Saying that a man is going to commit suicide on Christmas Eve for this cause he believes in, and then leading into his first national radio speech with this up-tempo version of "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow." But the John Doe character, played by Gary Cooper, does really end up taking to the job. He starts to believe in it, and he's inspiring people to be more neighborly and to stand up for the little guy, which is pretty fitting for the holiday season. These John Doe clubs pop up all over the country, and he goes around making speeches. Then, the night of the big speech at this huge rally where people from John Doe clubs across the country have come to hear him speak, our John Doe figures out that big business and big politics, all of these movers and shakers, are trying to manipulate his movement to get their own officials elected, and really to kind of counteract everything he's talking about. When he finds out, he bites back.
Well, that certainly is a new low. I guess I've seen everything now. You sit there back at your big cigars and think of deliberately killing an idea that's made millions of people a little bit happier. An idea that's brought thousands of them here from all over the country so they could pass on to each other their own simple little experiences. Why, your type's as old as history. If you can't lay your dirty fingers on a decent idea and twist it and squeeze it and stuff it into your own pocket, you slap it down. Like dogs, if you can't eat something, you bury it. People are finally finding out that the guy next door isn't a bad egg. The John Doe idea may be the answer, though. It may be the one thing capable of saving this cockeyed world, yet you sit back there on your fat hulks and tell me you'll kill it if you can't use it. Well, you go ahead and try. You couldn't do it in a million years because it's bigger than whether I'm a fake. It's bigger than your ambitions, and it's bigger than all the bracelets and fur coats in the world.
You bet it is, John.
And that's exactly what I'm going down there to tell those people.
So John Doe starts out as a fake, but he buys into this idea that sparks the movement. And it's a pretty simple idea. Love your neighbor. It's also an idea that we think about a lot this time of year. The movie Meet John Doe is dark, and it's this populist and scary to the status quo kind of story. It's like this combination of the Christmas story and the Easter story wrapped up in a big secular package. Do you think that sounds radical? I think it is. So you just need to watch the movie, because maybe Meet John Doe is the perfect film to watch this holiday season. And maybe it will inspire you to love your neighbor.
Behind the Scenes with guest commentator, Wake Forest University professor of communication, film studies, and women's and gender studies, Mary Dalton. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break now. But when we return, it'll be visual art all the way with Greensboro painter William Mangum, plus a salute to the unsung heroes in the world of art display, framers. That's right, it's the art of the frame, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and William Mangum has been a professional artist for 36 years, selling his art all over the world, running his own gallery, and giving back to the community. Bill's provided original art to the Honor Card program for 25 years, raising awareness about the homeless in our state. His involvement sprang from a chance meeting he had years ago with a homeless man named Mike Saavedra, who was unable to care for himself. Bill ultimately became Mike's caretaker, and he credits Mike for teaching him many of life's lessons. Bill's new book, Michael's Gift, An Artist's Journey to the True Meaning of Life, is his personal tribute.
You know, artists take from everywhere, you know, right in their own backyard sometimes. And I've always felt that it's an obligation to support and to give back, because people are supporting you. Being an artist is a unique privilege. And it's one that, for whatever reason, I just feel so blessed that people have gone out of their way to spend their hard-earned money for something that I do as a craft. But more importantly, art is so powerful because it can be a conduit for a great message. It can be very purpose-driven in the way that it supports a particular program, and it becomes a voice.
Well, it seems like one of the great examples of this notion of giving back, Bill, is really outlined in the Honor Card program, now coming up on a quarter century, which is a great landmark. But take us back.
Well, it was back in 1987 that I befriended a homeless individual by the name of Mike Saavedra. And Mike reached out to me and asked me for some money, and like most people, I wasn't comfortable doing that, so I asked him if he'd like some breakfast. And I bought him some breakfast. I had a little bit of time on my hand. And as I heard his story, I thought about that Good Samaritan passage in the Bible, and I thought, you know, that's something I could do. I could take him down to our local shelter. And I heard of Greensboro Urban Ministry, but I wasn't familiar with it. And as we got down there and Mike was getting out of the car, I really don't know what came over me, but I reached into my back pocket and I grabbed a business card and I gave it to him and I said, why don't you give me a call in a couple of days? Let me know how you're doing. And he did. And that turned into a 3-year friendship where ultimately I became Mike Saavedra's caretaker. Because not only was Michael homeless, he was also mentally ill. Mike was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia at the age of 15. And it was during those 3 years that Mike really pricked my heart to understand the plight of homelessness. And there was this little program that had just begun called the Honor Card for Greensboro Urban Ministry. And it was a card where you purchase it, but what you're doing is you're making a donation, you're making a contribution directly to that agency, and you send it to a friend or a family member, and it says a gift has been given in your honor to support the needy and homeless in our community. Well, back in 1988, the first year that I participated, the painting was called Not Forgotten, and we printed 7,500 cards, and it raised $53,000 that year. It was just remarkable. And for 16 years, I did this honor card on a regular basis for Greensboro, but I recognized that we should take this program and leverage it across the state. So with the help of Wells Fargo, as well as Mike and Sarah Kearney, we have now grown this program to 13 different cities in North Carolina, and this year we'll produce nearly 100,000 honor cards. 100% of the contributions and the proceeds go directly back to that agency.
25 years now, you've raised $4.5 million over that period of time. And at the heart of this, I'm just struck by it was really this relationship in which you gave to Mike, but in the same way, you got a lot back through that relationship. And it's all played out in this beautiful new book that you've got.
Well, thanks. It is. You know, recently I read an article talking about people of influence. And as you Google that, so often you see celebrities or you see personalities or athletes and maybe even sometimes political figures, although right now they may not be in the limelight. But nevertheless, the supporting characters oftentimes are the people behind the scenes. It's the cooks, the helpers. It's the people in the garage that really support those people of influence. And in so many ways, Mike really was that sort of a character for me. He was an underlying support that really gave me a better understanding to the true purpose and meaning of life. Mm. And it was through his humbleness and his ability to live day to day that was such a contrast to my desire to conquer the world as the greatest artist that ever lived. And that dichotomy between the two is really what this book is all about. It's a real celebration of his gift to me and the life lessons that I gleaned from him.
One of those life lessons is one that a lot of people are up against, is that sense of ego and pride. How did that relationship begin to break that down in your mind and then later your behavior?
As an artist, I have an unusual business acumen, so my approach is to conquer all the time, and I've had great success with that. But I felt that I could fix Mike. It was just a matter of regimen and a matter of consistency. But Mike was not fixable. You know, that mental illness was a disease that just really couldn't be handled at that particular time in our community. Now, today, I think it could be totally different with what has transpired since then. But what Mike did was he took us out of our comfort zone. One, to the point that even on a Sunday, he wound up in my Sunday school class, and I went, oh, you got to be kidding me. Here I am helping this guy 6 days a week, and now he's in my Sunday school class? Oh, my goodness, I wasn't just prepared for that. But our class reached out, and they did the best they could. And then, you know, I think we go through life, and you feel like it's just going to always continue. But the day that Mike died and I found him in his apartment, I was grateful for that, not knowing if he would have wandered into a ditch. But it just really said to me, life is too valuable, and I can take a little bit of my time each year to bring some awareness to this challenge that's really a stain in American society. And if nothing more, I really do believe that they're there for a purpose and that everybody contributes in some remarkable ways, and that life lessons can even come from a homeless, mentally ill individual.
And should let listeners know that the physical card itself is a work of art that you've created, and it's specific to these sorts of interactions and the Good Samaritan nature and how a moment can really impact an entire life.
It is. One of the best ways that the program, I think, has grown is because it's real. I continue to volunteer every Wednesday morning. I go down and I head up a prayer breakfast with an army of kids and some adults. And we serve, matter of fact, this morning we served nearly 200 individuals. It was really cold out there this morning.
Wow.
But it's seeing those and staying constantly in contact that's where the inspiration comes from. And within the beauty of the card is always a subtle message about homelessness. And the inspiration comes from a variety of ways. But people can pick up all of this, and they can find out where they can participate in the Honor Card across North Carolina by simply going to the honorcard.com website.
Tell me about this year's card.
Well, this year's card, as the 25th anniversary, I wanted to make it something special. And sometimes it's always been the focus of the individual. But this year, I wanted to celebrate the caretakers. So this year's card is called Fall Into Me. I was working in the studio one day, and there's this great band called Sugarland, and they have this wonderful song called Fall Into Me. And as I was listening to the lyrics, I began to jot them down, and I immediately started painting this image in my mind, and I knew from that point forward this was the backdrop for this year's creation. It's a gentleman that's down on his knees that's reaching out to befriend this homeless individual on a bench. And so often, that's exactly how God uses us. We are the conduit. We are the ability to help others. So that idea of homeless individuals, needy people falling into me, letting me help you, is really the celebration of this year's Honor Card.
And this is happening, and the new book is coming, and you're going into the furniture business as well. I mean, this is an exciting period in your life. Well, how did this collaboration begin?
Well, it's an amazing new chapter. It's one that I've actually been down in the past, but it never came to fruition, unfortunately. I'd actually signed a couple of license agreements 12 years ago. And unfortunately, as the collection was coming to the launch, the CEOs were let go of the companies, and so were my collections. But I had a good friend, Jeff Beeston, who's with Klausner Furniture here in Asheboro, North Carolina, called me back up in January, and he asked me if I would like to pursue this once again. And believe it or not, Jeff has done 35 different licensed collections. So as we met, he said, Bill, you know, art is so authentic, and it really tells a great message. And the thing about licensed home collections, what really makes them home runs, is if you've got great product. It's got to be good product, number one. But if you've got a good story to complement it, then it really can sell. Well, at the October Furniture Market, we launched this collection. It's called Carolina Preserves, and it's based on my second book that I did back in 2000. And it's a real tribute to the beauty of our state. You know, North Carolina is so diverse from the mountains to the coast. Under the masthead of Carolina Preserves, we have two collections. One's called Blue Ridge, which is this beautiful, handsome cherry finish, which is bedroom, dining, and occasional tables. And then the second collaboration is called Seabreeze, which is an off-white painted birch. So amazing contrast, and then you take the beauty of the upholstery and the ability to paint for fabrics and to create all that. All of this is just a marvelous new canvas for me to create on.
But set me down there in High Point that first day, Bill, were you nervous? The big launch.
No, I was so comfortable. I think that's what the reps were beside themselves, as they would bring dealers in, and we actually took my studio out of the gallery and moved it into the showroom. Klausner did an amazing job. And it was the touching points. It was the stepping stone to introduce these people as to who is William Mangum, what's my life like, but then to show them the original artwork and to show them how the furniture really is a part of me. One of the great pieces is called Imagination. It's a beautiful desk and hutch, and it's a soft iteration of my own studio piece that I create off. And I personally believe that everybody has a creative bent in their bone. They may not admit it, but a lot of people are great hobbyists, or they're collectors, or they design, or even doing things with their children. So two principal pieces in the collection, one's called the Imagination Desk with the hutch, and it's in cherry, and then there's this fantastic craft desk that's called Daydream. And I actually did this wonderful crayon drawing with my granddaughter Jaden on it. So I know it works for sure.
And from there, and Carolina Preserves going global.
Isn't that something? It was picked up by dealers in Russia, Kenya. I'm just blown away by, once again, the international aspects. For me, what's so exciting about this is that, unfortunately, art dealers and my personal trade, the art industry, sort of imploded after 9/11. And certainly the Great Recession took it asunder. We don't even have a trade show any longer or a trade magazine. So now I've got a new medium to work through. And so many of these art dealers are excited because they love the artwork that we had to go along with. We had 24 brand new pieces that were specific for the new collection Carolina Preserves. So I'm looking forward to traveling the country and putting this art in showrooms really all across America.
Artist and North Carolina native William Mangum. Bill's new book, Michael's Gift, An Artist's Journey to the True Meaning of Life, contains all 25 paintings of the annual honor card. 100% of all contributions support the agency, and so far they've raised $4.5 million to raise awareness about and to support the homeless. This year's card is titled Fall Into Me. Bill's new book is Michael's Gift, and his new home collection is titled Carolina Preserves. You'll find links to all three at WFDD.org. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. For Mark Hampton, framing is in his blood. His parents opened Hampton House Gallery back in 1977, and Mark's been involved in the business in one way or another ever since. Hampton House Art and Framing offers paintings, three-dimensional art, and digital photographic restoration services, but it's the framing that's captured Mark's imagination the most. He's attended several seminars and taken numerous framing courses, and beginning in January, he'll be teaching presentation and care of artwork at Sawtooth School for Visual Art.
A woman brought a photo in the other day, and it was her great-grandmother, and her great-grandmother was the first female nurse in the Civil War, and she actually tried to get to the front lines to aid the wounded soldiers, and no one would let her up front. She happened to be a friend of Abraham Lincoln and lobbied Lincoln to allow her up, and so he basically gave her the go-ahead to aid the guys on the front line. And so it's stories like that that just, I could hear that stuff all day long. You know, I just really like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
With every picture, there's a story behind it.
That's exactly right.
What are some common mistakes that someone comes in, say a customer comes in, a client, and wanting to have a picture framed that you see on a day-to-day?
Mm-hmm. So really two kind of thought processes, things you have to take into consideration when you frame an item. Number one is the aesthetics of it. And sometimes it's a Muppets poster, and they want it in a simple frame and just to put it on the wall and hang it. Very simple process. Sometimes it's a photo of your great-grandmother who was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln. You know, and in that instance, you handle the aesthetics of it would be different. For me, I really like to take into consideration the history of the piece, the style of architecture, because framing is directly related to architecture and design trends, but the style of the era the piece would have been executed in. And so we really want to frame that to where it looks kind of true to its roots, so to speak. And then the interior, the side that you never see, I kind of draw the analogy that it's like picking your car up from a mechanic. You know, and the mechanic sometimes can tell you exactly what needs to happen, and maybe that's the right thing, maybe it's the wrong thing, maybe something didn't get fixed well. But once the hood's closed, if the car turns over and drives for you, then you don't really question it, you know. With framing, it's the same way. There are archival methods that we employ that are not always visible. So those kind of, you asked, the initial question was about the mistakes that are made. A lot of that really can be done by the framer. The customer's main thing is if they bring the framer a piece of work, whatever that is, photograph, child's artwork, original artwork, if they bring that in good condition, then it's really my job to show them their options as far as style and design, but then also to know the correct way to handle that.
Are there instances where you would mix styles or no?
There are. It's funny because I was thinking about that on the ride over here. I was mostly thinking, though, of the instances where people have wanted us to mix styles and it's just gone horribly wrong.
Give me an example of that.
Somebody will come in and they'll have a beautiful old, you know, almost like an old master style painting. And, well, we have a very contemporary space it's going in, so we want a very contemporary frame on it. And, you know, we really are kind of in a gray area there because the customer knows what they want, but we kind of feel like we know what's going to look best on the piece, you know. So we always give the customer what they want, but we really try to churn up the gray area a little bit and sort of lead them to a kind of a happy mixture. But to see a very contemporary treatment on an antique piece, It just kills me sometimes. I'll tell you what I believe, you know, looks best on this or give you options, but it's not going to hang on my wall. So, you know, it's going to hang on your wall. I want you to be happy with it.
Let's talk about some of those tricks of the trade or some of the pillars and you know, how you do what you do, Mark, in terms of just the framing and matting of these things. Talk me through the process.
Yeah. So let's say you've come into the shop and you've brought whatever to be framed. The first thing we would really want to know is, how important is this to you? Is it an inexpensive poster that's going on your kid's wall? Okay, if so, we have a very quick and easy conversation. We pull down a colored frame or a black frame or whatever, and you know, the conversation kind of goes pretty quickly. Now, if this is a piece that's very important to you, maybe it has significant financial value, or maybe it has significant emotional value, then we really start to understand we're going to have to handle this piece a little differently. And we're going to get into different notions of the style. And so if it's a very important piece to you and you know where it's going to hang, or generally where it's going to hang, we will take into consideration what you have going on in the space. And there again, you may have a very traditional old master style piece, but you may live in a very contemporary home. We can really start looking at options on the matting and framing to really kind of bridge the gap between those two, to do the piece justice, but not make it stand out like a sore thumb in your space. So we would kind of start looking at matting, if matting's needed. Sometimes you're working with a piece on canvas. You wouldn't use matting traditionally. You would use, just a frame or a couple frames.
And by matting, you're meaning what sorts of materials you're talking about, and exactly just explain what the matting is.
Yeah. So the matting would be, typically people will come in who haven't had anything framed before, and they'll say, that colored border thing, and they'll point to, the broader, the wider border around the photo or image before you get to the frame. So matting really comes in a few different makeups. One is like a regular mat board, which is really meant to be on something very inexpensive. Over the years, you'll see the bevel, which is kind of the usually the crisp white line between the mat and the artwork. You'll see that bevel will brown. It may already be a little brown by the time the mat's cut. That's the acidities from the wood pulp that's in that mat board already kind of decomposing and breaking down. And so you wouldn't want to use a regular sheet of mat board on anything of any value.
And then I imagine you've got color concerns as well.
Yeah. The only real negative about the 4-ply rag mats, we talked about rag matting earlier, the only negative is they come in very limited colors. So let's say if you come into our shop, look at the color selections, we may have approximately 100 different colors of archival matting. If you came in just to look at 4-ply rag matting, maybe you're looking at about 25 or 30. And of those 25 or 30, you'll have 15 shades will be anywhere from white to beige gray, So you're kind of like in the boringish colors there, So that's really the negative there. But yeah, color really matters. And it matters because there again, you don't want the matting to overshadow the artwork. You want the matting to kind of be a nice segue from the wall to the frame to the artwork. And for that reason, we choose our colors very wisely.
Well, first off, I'm an appreciator of good framing because I've had good, bad, and the ugly, so I know there's a considerable skill involved in even the simplest mat. What are some things that have to take place? What can go wrong, and what do you do to compensate for that or to make sure it doesn't happen?
The main concern with what we deal with, the main thing that could go wrong would be that a customer's art would get damaged. And knock on wood, that has only seldom happened in our 36 years of doing this. So we really have a system in place to minimize damage. Folks know how to handle art. We know how to store art. Art's kept flat in its own space in our workshop. It's brought out only when it's time to be worked on. If it's something that's very, very delicate or very valuable, it may not be in our shop but a few days.
Now, in addition to taking courses yourself, you're giving courses at Sawtooth School for Visual Art. Talk me through a class. Put me in the seat there in the classroom. What sorts of things will you be going over?
Yeah. So first, what we'll discuss is what do you hope to get out of the course? Because if you are a photographer who wants to mat and mount your own work, you're going to be looking for something different than if you're just kind of doing this for gifts or things like that. Yet it will be basically the same process. But we'll figure out what everybody's looking for, and then we'll adjust the course accordingly. But we're going to talk a little bit about how to handle art. The most important thing we'll discuss, touching back on the notion of archival materials versus regular materials or, non-acid-free materials. So we're going to talk about the importance of that, and then we will kind of do some hands-on. There'll be mats there, have a mat cutter set up. I'll show everybody how to use the mat cutter. We'll do some color theory. Not too terribly much design will be done hands-on, but we'll go over that as well. It's a 2-weekend-long course. It's on Saturday, 2 Saturdays in January, and it's about 3 hours per class. So it'll give us plenty of time to do hands-on work. By the time you leave, you'll know how to use a nice tabletop mat cutter, and as well as mounting, archival mounting, and hinging of the mat to the mounting board, and the artwork to the mounting board, and all that good stuff. The sawtooth class is going to be a lot of fun, and whether you're, in that instance, whether you're a total novice or just want to kind of dust off the skills and get on a mat cutter, we'll be glad to teach you either way. And other than that, no, everything's good.
Thank you so much for coming to see me.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Hampton House Art and Framing's Mark Hampton. In January, Mark will offer his class Presentation and Care of Artwork at Sawtooth School for Visual Art. It begins Saturday, January 11th from 10 to noon, and the second class will meet the following Saturday from 10 to noon at the Sawtooth School in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to registration at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll also find links to Hampton House Art and Framing, now in their new location, 720 Coliseum Drive. Join Mark and his family there Saturday, December 7th, for their holiday open house from 10 to 5. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links, on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.